This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. District 87 Superintendent Designee Dave Mauser says he wants the job because he's eager to take the next step in his career and to find a new personal challenge. Mauser is currently head of Tri-Valley Schools in Downs and says he spent a fantastic quarter century in that district. Mauser will replace the retiring Barry Riley in Bloomington next July. School Board President Mark Wiley says Mauser's largest challenge will be helping kids stay on a social and emotional even keel, made more difficult by the pandemic. Mauser says he agrees.
You know, these last 22 months have been difficult for adults, and they've been really difficult for kids. And so when we talk about our routines changing and you talk about some kids not having been in school for long periods of time, you know, we've seen that students are having, they've had trouble. They've had trouble, especially the social and emotional piece, self-regulating, you know, being able to kind of get back on track with academics and activities and sort of having a full slate of things on their plates. And so without a doubt, Mark's right. This is going to be the issue for all schools. But at the same time, I think it's a false narrative to say that kids are way behind. I think kids are on a new trajectory. I think our kids are tough. I think they're going to be resilient. And I've already seen that. You know, to me, certainly it's something we want to keep an eye on, and we want to keep providing supports both academically and social and emotional. But at the end of the day, I have complete and total confidence in our kids and our staff to come through it. You know, I also think we have got to give credit to what our teachers have done over these last, 20-some months. I mean, it's completely redefining how education was done. The other big thing I think is going to be an issue for every school district is the teacher shortage. It's real, and it affects us, and we're talking about substitute teachers and teachers for our classrooms, and so those are going to be things that they're going to need to be on the radar for sure.
How do you think the teacher shortage should be addressed in District 87?
You know, number one, I'm hoping we can work to kind of homegrow, teachers along the way, and really just celebrate the profession and celebrate, what a positive thing it is to be involved in education, the impact you can make on the life of a child. Those are all things to be really proud of. And so, for me, it's about working with the universities and working with community colleges and also at the high school level with encouraging kids to consider education as a career path. But, at the end of the day, it's about the numbers that are coming through programs and folks wanting to stay in the profession. It's a tough job, and we need to work really hard to try to make sure that our teachers feel supported in the process of serving kids and that they have the opportunity to be able to focus on the child in front of them. And as administrators, we have to clear the path so they can get that done.
Tri-Valley is suburban and rural. District 87 is urban. How is that dynamic different?
Education is about relationships, and, I came through a large school system in Bloomington Normal, and have led a small school system. And so for me, the similarities, I think, stand out more than the differences do. I mean, obviously, there are differences, in terms of the communities. But at the end of the day, it's about creating those relationships and working with teachers so that they can focus on the kids that are in their classrooms. And I think when, we really break it down and boil it down to relationships and focusing on the child in front of you, the rest takes care of itself. And so I'm excited to just kind of watch and learn from the team at 87 and see how their operating principles are. I know they've got a great board of education that is all on the same page in terms of supporting kids. And so, to me, I'm really focused on the similarities and we'll tackle those differences as they come.
District 87 has had a structural budget deficit for some time. It's been manageable, but it's growing because of interest costs and expenses rising faster than revenues. How will you deal with that? What sort of roadmap do you think you'll have?
Well, obviously, my focus over the next 7 months is still going to be at Tri-Valley. We have our concerns and things that we're working on out here. So for me, as far as finance goes, I'm going to be focused on our issues. That's not to say we're not going to have those discussions with Dr. Riley and with the folks over at District 87. I think that, number one, we want to see EAVs increase locally. I mean, that's the one thing that I think, is exciting about what's happening in the Bloomington Normal area. We're starting to see, obviously, with Rivian and some of the other economic pieces, there's the possibility for EAV increases to take place, which obviously brings up, more revenue for schools. But then it's about, looking at programs, what we're offering, and how to be most efficient. And those are decisions that will be done over time.
The Republican Party in McLean County has announced plans to recruit candidates for school board races in the next cycle. This is part of a nationwide trend toward politicization of school boards in a way that that may be more systemic than the traditional kind of episodic instances that have gone on forever of candidates running who don't like a book or don't like a certain piece of curriculum. How will you address that trend when you arrive?
I don't think that's a trend we need to address. I mean, to me, if someone, you know, is choosing to be a public servant, choosing to run for, you know, for a position, they have every right to do so, you know. So, you know, for me, the focus is always going to be on doing everything we can within the system for the kids that we serve. And if somebody's interested in running and being a school board member and serving a community and serving children, I think that's a positive thing. I'm not overly concerned about the politics behind it at this point. I'm really concerned about serving the kids that I'm responsible for.
That's incoming District 87 Superintendent Dave Mauser. He says the history of success and the diversity of District 87 are exciting things to him. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The incoming CEO of Bloomington-based Growmark says innovation is crucial to the future of the huge co-op, and Mark Orr says carbon capture is one of the areas Growmark is exploring.
Really looking at how, you know, changing farming practices, cover crops, those type of things can help capture carbon and maybe offset what a company may make as a pledge out there. Farmers be able to actually get a new revenue source. So that's just one aspect we're looking at. I know we're doing another pilot project that we're looking at where we can capture carbon off some of our own transportation fleet, capture that and resell it back into the marketplace. So there's a lot of things going on in the space, and it's just a really exciting time to be involved in all the innovations available.
So there's a recent report out showing that farmer awareness of cover crops and other strategies is pretty high, but uptake is not. What's gonna move that marker?
There's two ways to look at that. One of it's got to be economically viable for the farmer. And today, the capture of the carbon is really not offsetting the cost of us to adopt those new practices. So, you know, step one is going to have to be just getting that economics right for the farmer to engage. The second piece is there's a group of farmers out there, you know, that just want to try this and try it on their farm. They believe in it. So those are the two areas that we see, you know, focus on moving forward. The ones that are already engaging, and the ones that are wanting to make sure that the ROI works for their organization.
Is Growmark going to need to have multiple strategies for farming practices and advice to its co-op members because different solutions will be needed at different latitudes as climate change progresses?
You know, for sure. We got to take a look at all the markets we serve. You know, we're not just corn and soybeans in Illinois. We farm. We have lots of different geographies we serve. The number of different specialty crops we serve today is much different than what it was just even 5 or 6 years ago. So we're about training our crop specialists who are in the field, you know, to bring the best agronomic advice and solutions for the customer. So there's no one-size-fits-all. For sure.
So, for example, how much have your specialty crops changed over that period?
A lot of that has just to do with where the geographies we serve, you know. We also have a vegetable seed company, Seedway, located in upstate New York. Which services really all the lower 48 states. So when you look at specialty crops, you know, we're involved in just about everything that there is out there. And, you know, we're just really about building our expertise to service those markets.
And technology, where are the most promising startups going to be happening? In what playing field?
Now, early on, what we're looking at is some of the logistics at our retail. How can we be better and more efficient, you know, from the distribution at the retail site to the farm gate? Understanding when a field's been sprayed, notifying the producer, making the most economical route to get products to where they need to go. So early on, there's a lot of digital things we're looking at in the logistics space, and we have a couple trials out there we're looking at there that look pretty promising.
Like what trials?
You know, we have a company called Salimptech as one we're looking at right now. We actually have several members that are utilizing that platform, and we've the process we go through is, we evaluate it for the first season. We want to make sure it's ready to go from a commercial standpoint. So this is the first year we actually launched it on a commercial standpoint. And, you know, we're seeing more efficiency and routing, getting to the fields that we need to serve.
Your latest publication indicates that this is a time of unparalleled opportunity for Growmark. What size company do you think you'll be in the next 10 years? How much growth do you expect?
You know, we are positioned well for growth, you know, and I would say we're a company that's not necessarily focused on the top-line dollars. We want to make sure that we're using the resources at hand, driving value for our members on a day-to-day basis. We also know that we have a large infrastructure support, and we can spread that cost out over a larger sales volume. That's what we're about. You know, we just finished up our full year with our partnership with Southern States, located primarily toward the East Coast in Kentucky, and that was a very successful first-year launch for us. So scaling over a bigger geography definitely adds benefit to all of our customers.
GrowMark CEO-designate Mark Orr will take over in March. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A hedge fund group with a reputation for buying out newspapers and then cutting staff has an eye on the publisher of the Bloomington-based Pantograph. Alden Global Capital made an offer to Lee Enterprises, which owns several papers across Illinois. WGLT's Lindsay Jones talks with Rick Edmonds, a media business analyst who writes for the Poynter Institute, about what the potential purchase means for local news in Bloomington Normal.
First of all, how serious is this?
I think it's likely that it will happen. Not a sure thing. It's an offer. It's not an agreement. But it's a premium over what Lee stock has been trading at. So 30% more than what the stock was trading at when it closed Friday. So that's attractive to shareholders to approve it, the board and shareholders. There's always possibility somebody else will come along with a higher bid or the company will try to resist, but I think it's likely that Alden will be in control of that whole group of papers by early next year.
We've been talking about the price per share. Do you have a total that this would be, like a dollar amount?
There's a little bit of a trick there that Alden already owns 6% of the stock. So for the remaining 94%, I think they'd be paying around $135 million. But they also have to assume Lee's debt, and that's like another $550 million. So it's or $540. So it's going to be around $680 million when you put those two things together.
What prompts Alden Capital's interest in newspaper companies in particular? I mean, what's the strategy for Alden there?
Well, I think Alden feels that they can make money for at least some period of time, particularly as they cut the operating costs by these various cutbacks. And if that happens, it's a successful investment for them. And as I was indicating a minute ago, they, in addition to whatever money they can make on an operating basis, they can probably sell real estate for more than Lee can do. I mean, they just have a very big real estate operation, and that actually applies to some of the other things that aren't newspapers they've invested in.
What can we expect from a proposed deal like this? The topic of the day is kind of Alden's penchant for cutting newsrooms, but Lee Enterprises has that reputation as well.
I agree with you. I would describe Lee, and if you live with Lee, they are a company that operates, on a very tight budget, and they probably made some number of cuts already, but I would expect more of those in the newsroom and sort of somewhat smaller papers, less local reporting. That's kind of been typical of the papers that they do own, and there's some of that going on. They bought Tribune Publishing papers in the summer, and that includes, of course, some very big papers like the Chicago Tribune, and actually most of them are fairly good sized metros. They've made some cuts there, not huge cuts, so it's a little bit remains to be seen what's going to happen there. But I think what matters to your audience probably is what's going to happen to the paper and its digital report. I mean, I think that's now part of the question. And as you suggest, something I've written about quite a lot, again, others have too, is that we've sort of reached a period where the newspaper is not, kind of like the biggest dominant game in town and everything else flows from the newspaper. There are quite a lot of alternative sources that come up. Public radio is an important source of local news. So You know, I think the phrase ecosystem is a good one because you have just a number of different outlets that are contributing to however much local news there is in a given place.
That's media business analyst Rick Edmonds of the Poynter Institute speaking with WGLT's Lindsay Jones. In an internal press release, Lee Enterprises says its board of directors will carefully review the offer from Alden Capital.
This week on Code Switch, books by Indigenous authors.
The representation of Indigenous people in books when I was a kid was either misrepresented or was based on stereotypes.
Then on NPR's Life Kit, how to be a good host.
The role of the host is really to take care of the life of the group.
That's on Code Switch and Life Kit from NPR.
Listen Saturday afternoon at 1 on 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The COVID vaccine is a big reason why we'll soon be able to share a big holiday meal together with our extended families for the first time in 2 years. And the vaccine is also a reason why that might be miserable. That's because the life-saving vaccine is strangely polarizing, and it's bound to be a thorny topic of dinner conversation at Thanksgiving and beyond. To help us navigate family vaccine etiquette, Ryan Denham speaks with Matt Mullenauer, Chief Clinical Officer at Bloomington-based Chestnut Health Systems. They start with a simple dilemma. What should you consider if your vaccinated family is invited to a gathering where you know Uncle Bob or Aunt Alice are not vaccinated?
But I think it comes down to just a respect for people's personal choice. And in your example, a family may have to decide that they're not going to attend out of their own discomfort because of the status of everybody else or questioning that. But I think one of the tricks in there, Ryan, is do they really know the status of everybody else? Is it an open conversation in the family? Can we assume that Uncle Bob is unvaccinated, or is he very vocal and we know that as a fact based on his Facebook profile or whatever, and how that then changes things. So I think it's a lot about being really upfront and then judging your own comfort while trying to not judge someone else's stance or position.
How appropriate is it to ask, are you guys vaccinated by chance? Should we be masked up in your house? How much prodding do you think is appropriate there?
The unfortunate part is the second you ask the question, it's labeled, it's judged, it's critiqued, it's you must think I'm wrong if I'm not, or how I answer or whatever. And really, it's simply a gathering of facts at this point. So who's all coming? And, you know, whoever the host is, are you aware of the vaccination status for everybody who's coming? And we'd be interested in knowing. And that's because we're protecting our family, but we're interested in protecting everybody else who's there as well. And so I think it has to be a fair topic. And if you think of a typical Thanksgiving or Christmas family get together, you know, who's bringing stuffing, who's bringing pie, who's got vaccine should be right on the list of questions. It shouldn't be treated any different.
Okay. Once you're actually at a family get together and people start talking and it's, oh, did you hear what President Biden did on this? Or did you hear what Aaron Rodgers said about ivermectin or whatever? And I think, you know, people struggle with like, how much should I engage here? Should I just kind of let the person talk? Should I engage and go back and forth with them?
If you're walking into an environment and you're aware that there's the possibility of disagreement, it may be worth the extra step to just say, okay, the following topics are off limits during this event. We're not going to talk politics. We're not going to talk COVID. We're not going to talk, you know, Aaron Rodgers. I mean, whatever it is you want to say, but the following topics are off limits. And, you know, we're here to spend time as family and we're not going to get into debate. In scenarios where I think the person's opinion is unknown, it's interesting, Brian, my observation of this, and this comes from kind of my mental health background, you know, this has been a really rough 18 months, 2 years for people. I mean, you take COVID and you pile politics on top of it and labor shortages and all that stuff and, you know, can't find goods and supplies and all of that. What the natural reaction for most people is to kind of become a little self-defensive. You know, how do I protect myself? How do I protect my family? That's physically, but it's also how do I protect my belief system? And so very quickly, someone who has a different belief system than I do, I will be tempted to defend my belief system as right and prove that person's belief system is wrong. And I think that's the trap we're all falling into right now.
So much of our digital lives now are spent, like on social media, inside of these little echo chambers and silos of people who generally agree with you on a lot of this, you know, COVID stuff or politics in general. And so these family gatherings are like one of those few cases where you are literally in a room and face to face with people who maybe don't share your political belief system. And it just doesn't typically happen that often.
Yeah. Don't you think it's become divisive, though? I mean, wasn't there a point in time where people could sit around the table and talk differences in opinion on the political side and not have it be judged as false news or judged as unfactual or judged as frankly wrong? And I think we've lost touch with that. I mean, you never heard, I never remember growing up, you know, my dad saying that he wasn't going to talk to the neighbor because they were a Democrat or a Republican. And now you get this in the context of even family dynamics. And I think that comes out of, I really do believe it comes out of the stress of the last year, and that you can tie all of this to this idea that, you know, when pushed into a corner, what do? I have to defend myself. And so I have been stressed out for whatever number of reasons in the last year and a half. So I will defend, you know, my belief system, and I'll do that pretty vehemently, you know, I being any individual. And in order to do that, that means I have to judge everybody else's belief system as wrong. You know, how are we going to get past this idea that it's a conversation without it being riddled with judgment and conflict and, you know, and flying stuffing, for lack of a better term, you know?
That's Matt Molenauer, the Chief Clinical Officer for Bloomington-based Chestnut Health Systems. He spoke with Ryan Denham. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. You can find all our Sound Ideas interviews and stories at WGLT.org. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media.